There are many things that I really like about being here at Monte Vista. Two of those things I want to talk about in short by way of introduction. I love, first of all, that we have so many kids and that those kids are treated as well as they are. There's so much attention given to our kids, so much attention and detail and thought put into the Bible class curriculum here. Our elders clearly love all the kids, and the kids enjoy being around their elders, both the elders proper as well as all of our older Christians, our older members here. We have a great relationship with our children here at Monte Vista. And the second thing, going along those lines, is that you have always treated my children really well, and I appreciate that very much. My kids have never felt like preacher's kids. That was one of the big concerns I had when I first became a preacher. I'd always heard all of these horror stories from people in the past of preacher's kids ends up being rebellious, and preacher's kids always have all of these pressures put on them because they live in the glass house, and there's extra expectation placed upon them, and they have never felt that, and I have never gotten the impression from you that that is put upon them. You know I'm not the perfect parent, and I tend to make a lot of wisecracks about my kids because they're easy targets. See, right there. But I do love my children very much. They know it. I tell them all the time. And for some strange reason, they also love me. So when I talk about parenting from the pulpit, you know that it is not some self-derived wisdom that I'm trying to share with you. All I can do is share with you some of the insights that people have given me over the years, as well as what the Bible has to say about disciplining and trying to raise our children in a way that is godly and in a way that is wise. We want to shape the will, says one writer. Dr. James Dobson, out of the book called The New Strong-Willed Child. Our objective, he writes, is not simply to shape the will, but to do so without breaking the spirit. The will is malleable. It can and should be molded and polished, not to make a robot of a child for our selfish purposes, but to give him or her the ability to control their impulses and exercise self-discipline later in life. On the other hand, the spirit of a child is a million times more vulnerable than his will. It is a delicate flower that can be crushed and broken all too easily. The spirit, as I have defined it, relates to the self-esteem or the personal worth that a child feels. It is the most fragile characteristic in human nature, being particularly vulnerable to rejection and ridicule and failure. And one way that I would think about the will versus the spirit is in a bonsai tree. My dad and my grandfather love bonsai trees. They both craft them and grow them and very delicately shape them over many years. My grandfather has several bonsais in his collection that are over 50 years old, and he has curated them and taking care of them all of those years. My dad's not quite as experienced as Grandpa is, but they certainly love to talk bonsai trees when they're together. The thing about a bonsai is that it does take a lot of time to carefully shape it. The goal of a bonsai tree is to make a tiny tree. But tiny trees are fragile. Tiny trees are very sensitive. If you overwater them or underwater them, if you over-fertilize them or use the wrong kind of fertilizer, too much sun or too little, too much hot, too much cold, and if you accidentally cut off the wrong branch, or you mold it too strongly, or you don't prune it at all, almost anything can ruin a bonsai tree. The pot, on the other hand, is pretty tough. And I think when you look at a bonsai tree in its pot, perhaps one way you can think about the will versus the spirit is that the will can be shaped and should be shaped. And you can change the will, and you can move the will, and you can mold the will. And the will can be, if you want it to go this way, the will can go that way, but it takes patience. And you have to be careful with how you do it. What happens, though, if you shove a bonsai tree off a table? What happens to the pot? It can be shattered. And it can't be fixed. If we break our kid's spirit, it's like the pot underneath the bonsai. It'll shatter. And we will have a very hard time finding all the pieces and putting them back together. The Bible talks about discipline as well. And the Bible doesn't pull any punches either. God's direction for discipline is simple. In Proverbs 19, verse 18, it says, "Discipline your son while there is hope, and do not desire his death." Now, I know that that seems like an extreme thing to say, but I do wonder in our hearts how close maybe we have come to that in our own parenting, how frustrated we become if we ever even just have the thought pass through our minds without it passing between our lips of thinking, "I wish that I was free. I wish that he wasn't there. I wish that she wasn't there. I wish that my life was different from what it is now because things have changed, they're irreparable, and everything that I thought I was is no longer." Now, we might not say we want them to die, but if there is any longing in our hearts that life would just be different without them, then perhaps this verse is a little too real for us. In Proverbs chapter 13, verse 24, "He who spares his rod hates his son, but he who loves him disciplines him diligently." Notice, this is the same with the bonsai. The bonsai requires discipline, doesn't it? If you don't discipline it, it's not really a bonsai tree. It's just a bush or a houseplant that looks like a houseplant. If you don't discipline it, it might overgrow or it might become withered up and die because of a lack of sunlight or too much sunlight. It's on you as the curator to take care of it properly. And it needs discipline. Proverbs 22, verse 15, "Foolishness is bound up in the heart of a child. The rod of discipline will remove it far from him." Now, whether you're talking about bonsais or raising children or raising dogs and cats, it is absolutely true that foolishness is bound up in their nature. Just observe the way that a dog, as Peter points out in one of his epistles, returns to its vomit. You always wonder, what about that? What is it about a dog's nature? What built-in characteristic? What is his instinct that says, "I just got rid of that, probably better try it again"? But that's foolishness bound up. Now, maybe our kids aren't quite that foolish, but when they're standing on the back of the couch ready to break their necks at a single moment, you can see the way that the Bible is absolutely correct about that. Or in Proverbs 23, verse 13, "Do not hold back discipline from the child. Although you beat him with the rod, he will not die. You shall beat him with the rod and deliver his soul from Sheol." There has to be some perspective in our discipline and realize that as we discipline our children, we're not doing it so that we can have peace and quiet. We're not disciplining them so that we can personally be satisfied. The goal in discipline is to try and get our children to go to heaven. That's the goal, isn't it? So I want to discipline my children in a way that they grow up to be mature, spiritual people who love God and who are able to control themselves and practice self-discipline without me micromanaging every little part of their lives. All of these verses illustrate the same thoughts when it comes to discipline. First of all, we must in no way under-prioritize rules, boundaries, and consequences. Second, no matter how inconsistent life becomes, we need to remain consistent as parents, that they see the same things from us from day to day to day. The will, third, is what needs to be shaped. Actions will follow once we have won our children's hearts to the side of what is right. Now, you can break their spirit. You can break them into submission. You can make them do the right thing. But if you've broken the spirit, it's too late. The pot is shattered. We want to bend and mold and shape the will, my friends. And fourth, be afraid of the right things. Rather than being afraid of making children unhappy or being afraid of not being their buddy, or being afraid of being unpopular with their friends, we need to be afraid of the eternal consequences of an unrepentant lifestyle. Maybe instead of being so scared that your kids don't like you, be scared of the image of your kids in hell. And let that shape, at least at first, the way that you discipline your children and try to help them to become godly individuals. So if we're going to handle the fragile spirit, we must figure out how. And of course, while discipline and correction and rule enforcement are all absolutely necessary in raising children, what should always be off limits is any accusation that assaults the worth of your child. Now, maybe you've never said a phrase like this, but perhaps you've thought it. Or worse, maybe you have said something like this. These are all off limits, my friends. You've been a pain in the neck ever since you were born. I never wanted you in the first place. You're an embarrassment to me. You're a burden on me. We never want to send the message that our children are unloved or unwanted or unnecessary in our lives. They should never be seen as an embarrassment or a mistake, because this cuts to the very core of what makes a human feel valuable. Our children may do dumb things, but they should never be made to feel dumb. In the same way, we all commit sins, even after we become Christians. But that doesn't mean that we're sinners by nature, that we're inherently or totally sinful. Remember, even as imperfect people, we are still called holy and blameless people in Ephesians 1 verse 4. And perhaps we can point out to our children when they make mistakes and what that mistake is, and tell them that was a bad thing you did, but that doesn't mean you are bad. You can do far better. You're capable of better. How can a spirit be broken then? I think there are several Bible passages that point out how to break the spirit. And these are just other ways of saying what we've already said. You're an embarrassment. You're a burden. I never wanted you. These are just other ways of saying those very phrases. In Proverbs 12 verse 18, the writer says, "There is one who speaks rashly like the thrusts of a sword, but the tongue of the wise brings healing." It is often what we say in the heat of the moment that causes the most damage to our children's spirits. That's what breaks our relationships. When we talk in a marriage, it's the same way. It's not just with raising kids, but between a husband and a wife. In the heat of the moment, we will say something to our spouse that we never really mean, and that we would never, ever say. We would never even think of saying it under cooler circumstances. But in the heat of the moment, like the thrust of a dagger, we just let it go. We let it fly. It's always best to avoid saying things that can never be taken back. Just like the writer says, it's the thrust of a dagger. And once you stab somebody, there's no going back from that, right? There's also in Proverbs 15, verse 4, "A soothing tongue," the writer says, "is a tree of life, but perversion in it crushes the spirit." I've always liked New American Standard, where it says, "Perversion in it crushes the spirit." Our own lack of discipline as parents can be a source of great discouragement for our children. It's interesting to see from this verse that the role that perversion can play in warping the spirit of another person, especially a child. Now, perhaps this is an extreme case, but when you have perversion in your life in the form of pornography, for example, don't ever think for a moment that that's something that won't affect your children, that your kids won't ever find out, that they won't ever see it, that they won't ever be exposed to it themselves. And the pornography in your life becomes a seed that is planted in your own son's life. And you have nobody to blame for his problems but you, if you can't manage to keep the perversion out of your life. The perversion in your tongue. I love the way that that word puts it, because that's what it is. Perversion. Now, it doesn't have to be pornography. It could be the kind of jokes that we tell, or the kind of television shows that we watch. The kind of humor that we use says a lot about who we are. And when we say things, as parents, your dad, your mom, they look up to you, but when we say things as parents that are immature or cowardly or inane or foolish or stupid, we disturb our children. We distort our children with things that just don't belong in the mind or lips of a mature, strong, responsible Christian. Ephesians chapter 5 puts it best. when the writer says there in verses 3 through 5, "But do not let immorality or any impurity or greed even be named among you as is proper among saints. There must be no filthiness and silly talk or coarse jesting which are not fitting, but rather giving of thanks. For this you know with certainty, that no immoral or impure person or covetous man who is an idolater has an inheritance in the kingdom of Christ and God." Proverbs chapter 17, verse 22. "A joyful heart is good medicine, but a broken spirit dries up the bones." And if we remember the context in Proverbs 17, we find that the previous verse actually speaks of the heartache caused by a foolish child. The implication is, then, that the greatest source of a crushed spirit is trouble in the family. Now, our children might be very smart and very good at things. They might have many talents. They might be musicians and artists and poets, and they might get very good grades in school. But when they come home and there's trouble in the family, that will hurt them more than anything else in life. To hear mom and dad screaming at each other and throwing things across the room. To hear them constantly talking about, "Woe is us, we don't have enough money, we don't have enough money, we don't have enough money." You know, I'm quite convinced upon recollection that we didn't have enough money when we were growing up, but I give my parents a ton of credit because we never knew it. Maybe we were just playing with cardboard boxes all the time because that's what we could afford, but we felt very rich growing up because our parents never talked about money in front of us. They never talked about it when we didn't have it. And when my dad became more successful in his career, they didn't talk about it when we did have it. Money was not the operating force in our family life. And I love my parents because of the way that they raised us in that regard. Fighting bad tempers and bitterness can cause our children to dry up in their soul like a dry bone. Proverbs 15, verse 13. "A joyful heart makes a cheerful face, but when the heart is sad, the spirit is broken." Again, these are all verses about the broken spirit. These are all verses about the pot of clay that's been crushed on the floor. Good family morale is priceless, my friends. Even if you're not a perfect family, and none of us are, really. None of us are perfect families. But even if you're not a perfect family, and you don't have enough money to go do everything that your heart wants to do, keep your family happy. My mother-in-law is here this morning, and I love Susan so much. Best mother-in-law that a man could ever want. I'm going to make her cry this morning. That's my goal, is to make her cry. Because I'm not the best son-in-law that a mother would want. But we were talking just yesterday, actually, about Kid Day. When they were growing up, Rebecca and Jennifer got to pick an activity every Saturday. Now, partly that's because Baghdad, Arizona is really boring and there's absolutely nothing to do, so they've got to do something to spice up a Saturday morning. But even if it was as simple as going to the park or going to get a donut or something, that they got Kid Day, and they might not have had the money to go to Disneyland, they might not have had the money to go do this or that, but when the girls got to pick something to do, even if it was just a free trip to the park, that boosts family morale. Read this verse again. "A joyful heart makes a cheerful face, but when the heart is sad, the spirit is broken." And if you come home from work a miserable wretch, and if you end every single day with a heave and a sigh, and your kids come home from school and you're just sitting there on the couch waiting for the day to be over, you don't think that's going to have an impact on them as well? That you're not crushing their spirit? All of this lines up with Satan's strategy, by the way. This is everything that Satan wants. Because God's goal for us is for us to shape the will of our children in order to build up their spirit. Words like self-worth, confidence, competence, these are beautiful, built-up words, aren't they? These are empowering words, and this is what God wants from our children. A strong spirit that knows that it is valuable enough. It knows that God so loved the world that He gave His only begotten Son for me, for you, for our kids as well. That's God's goal in our parenting. Satan wants, though, to see that our children's will shapes us. Satan wants our mood to be impacted by our children's disobedience. Satan wants us to be discouraged by the things that they say, by the things that they do, so that in response to the things they say and do that are disobedient or rebellious or rude or disrespectful or perverted, that we become angry and break their spirits in our frustration and our impatience. Your mom and dad, you're the parent. God sets the tone in your life, and you, by God's will, set the tone in their lives. Satan's goal is to use your children to set the tone in your life, to destroy your spirit with the immaturity of your children, who cannot help it, who cannot be any more mature than children. Why are we so shocked and mad when our children yell and scream at us? They're children. Why are we so shocked and mad the first time our kids have a trouble in school or have a conflict with a classmate? They're children. Why do we get so angry when our children disobey us the first time? They're children. And we can't expect them to be any more than children. And our lives cannot be shaped by their immaturity. We must avoid the following traps then if we don't want to fall for Satan's tricks. We need to be careful that we're not so afraid of enforcing rules that we don't want to destroy the relationship that we have with our kids or with their friends. We make up excuses. Well, if I give them a curfew, they'll never like me and they'll never make good friends. If I don't let them participate in that activity on Wednesday night and miss Bible class on Wednesday night, well, then they'll never be successful. If I don't keep them home on Wednesday night so that they can do all of their homework, they'll never excel in school. Well, then we've made a compromise, haven't we? And we're so afraid of enforcing the rules because we don't want to destroy this perceived popularity that we have with our kids. How about wanting to be our children's buddy instead of being their parent? One of the great things about reality television, and this is one of the very few redeeming qualities about reality television, is when you get to look into the lives of housewives in Orange County, what you see is a bunch of mothers and fathers who want nothing more than to still be teenagers and be popular with their kids and their kids' friends. Wanting to be popular with our children instead of doing what's best for them. Deciding not to enforce the rules or to exercise discipline because we're too tired to do it, or that it will just create too much stress in the family. Just let him have what he wants so we can all have a moment of peace and quiet. Avoiding confrontation and discipline because we want some temporary peace and quiet. Pretending that the rebellion will just naturally go away and that our children will just mature on their own if we just leave them to it. Maybe we can look back in our own lives. Maybe we didn't have perfect parents, or we were raised in a single family household, or we said, well, I turned out just fine. And that might be the case, and good for you. You turned out just fine in spite of the challenge that was presented to you. Why not try to give our kids the best opportunity, though? Why not try to give our kids the best opportunity instead of just sending them out in the world and saying, hey, I did okay, you'll be fine. As we bring our lesson to a close, I want to say two bad words. No, not the two bad words that you're thinking. Shame on you. There are two bad words in parenting that we need to avoid. Exasperation and provocation. We must avoid the two bad words of parenting, of exasperation and provocation, with every fiber of our being, because those two things more than anything else will contribute to the destruction of our families and the brokenness of our kids' spirit. As it says in Colossians 3, verse 19, of exasperation, fathers, Do not exasperate your children that they may not lose heart. I think that's another way of saying that they may not have a broken spirit. There's a big difference between being exasperated and just being upset with our kids, being pushed to our limits. A child may not like the rules. A child may not like the consequences or the discipline that comes with disobedience. But if we have shaped the will and built up their spirit, they will eventually come to their senses and appreciate the discipline that we give. Earlier in our worship service, our scripture reading was from Hebrews chapter 12, verses 7 through 11. I'd like to pick a few selected phrases from that where the writer says, "Furthermore, we had earthly fathers who disciplined us, and we respected them." Now, at the time, it wasn't pleasant. At the time, it wasn't pleasant. As the writer says, all discipline for the moment seems not to be joyful, but sorrowful. Yet to those who have been trained by it, afterward it yields the peaceful fruit of righteousness. Good parents do not exasperate their children. Good parents do not push their children to the breaking point. Good parents discipline their children. And they earn respect because of it. This is an invaluable step in a person's maturation process, by the way. We see it in the news all the time today, don't we? Learning to accept the rules, even when the rules upset us. That is a lesson that we cannot avoid forever. And either we'll learn it in our homes when we're 9 or 10 or 12 or 15, or we'll go out into the world unprepared to deal with the things that we don't like when we're 18 or 22 or 25 or 30. Guess what? You don't get everything you want out of life. Isn't life about adjusting to other people and adjusting to strenuous circumstances that tell us, no, you don't get to have your own way right now? Just because you don't like something doesn't mean you get to throw a hissy fit when you're 20 or 30 or older. But the next word is provocation. And it's a very bad word. Ephesians 6 verse 4 says, "Fathers, do not provoke your children to anger, but bring them up in the discipline and instruction of the Lord." Friends, there's an accountability that comes with parenting. You can't just enter into parenting on a lark. Parenting is not a hobby that you pick up every now and then, like model trains. Parenting isn't like reading either. I just don't feel like doing it. There is responsibility that comes with parenting. You're shaping human beings, their will, what kind of a person they're going to become when they grow up. Fathers, do not provoke your children to anger. What does provoking your children to anger look like? Provoking involves pushing their buttons on purpose. Provoking is driving them so hard for success that they become fried out, broken. Provoking is forcing them to do activities or sports that bring them unhappiness just because you had some broken or unfulfilled dream of your own in your own adolescence. Provoking them also means taking out your anger on them because they're easy targets. Fathers and mothers, do not provoke your children. So as we build up the spirit and shape the will, consider saying things like this: I believe in you. Even when you make mistakes, you're my son, you're my daughter, and I believe in you. You are so precious to us. It's not just that I would die for you in the heat of the moment. It's that I will live for you today, tomorrow, and every day in the little things, not just the grand gestures. I am so glad that God answered my prayers and He gave you to us. You are a gift from God. You have given us so much joy. And you are so talented and so gifted, and so full of potential. That makes a difference in a kid's life, doesn't it? In who they become. Now, I told you at the beginning, there's no self-derived wisdom here. All I can do is take the things that I've studied and the advice that's been given to me, the insight of better parents than myself, and pass that on to you. I admit my imperfection. I know you do as well. I don't think there's a parent in here who doesn't think and look back on the mistakes that they've made over the years, the things they wish they'd done a little bit differently. But you know what? As long as your kids are still alive, even if they're grown up 20 or 30 or 40 years old, as long as your kids are still alive and breathing, we can still have an impact on them and a good influence and lead them to God, which ultimately is the goal that we have. Now, if you're not a Christian here this morning, you really ought to be. Become a Christian now by putting on Christ in baptism. That is the only way to be a part of His kingdom. It is the only way to have your sins washed away. And if you believe that Jesus is the Son of God and you're willing to confess that belief and to repent of your sins and put a life of sin behind you, and if you're willing to consent and obey and be baptized, you can become a Christian this very day. So whatever need you might have, let it be known by coming forward as we stand and sing.